Chapter 22. The Ritual of Chud. 1. In the Lair of It. 1958. It was Bill who held them together as that great black spider raced down its web, creating a noxious breeze that tousled their hair. Stan shrieked like a baby, his brown eyes bulging from their sockets, his fingers harrowing his cheeks. Ben backed slowly away until his ample ass struck the wall to the left of the door. He felt cold fire burn through his pants and stepped away again, but dreamily, surely, none of this could be happening. It was simply the world's worst nightmare. He found he could not lift his hands. They seemed to have big weights tied to them. Richie found his eyes drawn to that web, hanging here and there, partially wrapped in silken strands that seemed to move as if alive, were a number of rotted, half-eaten bodies. He thought he recognized Eddie Corcoran near the ceiling, although both of Eddie's legs and one of his arms were gone. Beverly and Mike clung to each other like Hansel and Gretel in the woods, watching, paralyzed, as the spider reached the floor and scrabbled toward them, its distorted shadow racing along beside it on the wall. Bill looked around at them, a tall, skinny boy in a mud and sewage-splattered T-shirt that had once been white, jeans with cuffs, mud-caked keds. His hair lay across his forehead, and his eyes were blazing. He surveyed them, seemed to dismiss them, and turned back toward the spider. And, incredibly, he began to cross the room toward it, not running, but walking fast, his elbows cocked, his forearms corded, his hands fisted. You killed my brother! No, Bill! Beverly shrieked, struggling free of Mike's embrace and running toward Bill, her red hair flying out behind her. Leave him alone! She screamed at the spider. Don't you touch him! Shit, Beverly, Ben thought. And then he was running too, stomach swaying back and forth in front of him, legs pumping. He was vaguely aware that Eddie Kasprak was running on his left, holding his aspirator in his good hand like a pistol. And then it was rearing up over Bill, who was unarmed. It buried Bill in its shadow, its legs pawing at the air. Ben grabbed for Beverly's shoulder. His hand slapped it, then slipped off. She turned toward him, her eyes wild, her lips drawn back from her teeth. Help him! She screamed. How? Ben screamed back. He wheeled toward the spider, heard its eager mewling, looked into its timeless evil eyes, and saw something behind the shape, something much worse than a spider, something that was all insane light. His courage faltered, but it was Bev who had asked him. Bev, and he loved her. God damn you, leave Bill alone! He shrieked. A moment later, a hand swatted his back so hard he almost fell over. It was Richie. And although tears were running down his cheeks, Richie was grinning madly. The corners of his mouth seemed to reach almost to the lobes of his ears. Spit leaked out between his teeth. Let's get her, Haystack! Richie screamed. Chud! Chud!
Her?
Ben thought stupidly. Her? Did he say? Aloud. Okay, but what is it? What's Chud? Frocked if I know! Richie yelled. Then ran toward Bill and ran into the shadow of it. It had somehow squatted on its rear legs. Its front legs pawed the air just over Bill's head. And Stan Uris, forced to approach, compelled to approach, in spite of every instinct in his mind and body, saw that Bill was staring up at it, his blue eyes fixed on its inhuman orange ones, eyes from which that awful corpse light spilled. Stan stopped, understanding that the ritual of Chud, whatever that was, had begun. 2. Bill in the Void. Early.
Who are you, and why do you come to me?
I'm Bill Denbro. You know who I am, and why I'm here. You killed my brother, and I'm here to kill you. You picked the wrong kid, bitch.
I am eternal. I am the eater of worlds.
Yeah? That's so? Well, you've had your last meal, sister.
You have no power. Here is the power. Feel the power, brat. And then speak again of how you come to kill the eternal. You think you see me? You see only what your mind will allow. Would you see me? Come then. Come, brat. Come.
Throne. He. No, not throne. Fired. Fired like a living bullet. Like the human cannonball at the Shrine Circus that came to Derry each May. He was picked up and heaved across the spider's chamber. It's only in my mind, he screamed at himself. My body's still standing right there, eye to eye with it. Be brave. It's only a mind trick. Be brave. Be true. Stand. Stand.
Thrusts.
Roaring forward, slamming into a black and dripping tunnel lined with decaying, crumbling tiles that were 50 years old, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000,000,000, who knew? Rushing in deadly silence past intersections, some lit by that twisting green-yellow fire, some by glowing balloons full of a ghastly white skull light, others dead black. He was thrown at a speed of 1,000 miles an hour past piles of bones, some human, some not, speeding like a rocket-powered dart in a wind tunnel, now angling upward, but not toward light, but toward dark, some titanic dark.
His fists.
And exploding outward into utter blackness. The blackness was everything. The blackness was the cosmos and the universe, and the floor of the blackness was hard, hard. It was like polished ebonite, and he was skidding along on his chest and belly and thighs like a weight on a shuffleboard. He was on the ballroom floor of eternity, and eternity was black.
Against the posts.
Stop that.
Why do you say that? That won't help you, stupid boy. And still insists. He sees the ghosts.
Stop it. He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts.
Stop it. Stop it, I demand. I command that you stop it.
Don't like that, do you? And thinking, if I could only say it out loud, say it without stuttering, I could break this illusion.
This is no illusion, you foolish little boy. This is eternity, my eternity, and you are lost in it, lost forever, never to find your way back. You are eternal now, and condemned to wander in the black. After you meet me, face to face, that is.
But there was something else here. Bill sensed it, felt it in a crazy way, smelled it. Some large presence ahead in the dark. A shape. He felt not fear, but a sense of overmastering awe. Here was a power which dwarfed its power. And Bill had only time to think incoherently, please, please, whatever you are, remember that I am very small. He rushed toward it and saw it was a great turtle, its shell plated with many blazing colors, its ancient reptilian head slowly poked out of its shell, and Bill thought he felt a vague, contemptuous surprise from the thing that had cast him out here. The eyes of the turtle were kind. Bill thought it must be the oldest thing anyone could imagine, older by far than it, which had claimed to be eternal.
What are you?
I'm the turtle, son. I made the universe, but please don't blame me for it. I had a bellyache.
Help me! Please help me!
I take no stand in these matters.
My brother!
Has his own place in the macroverse. Energy is eternal, as even a child such as yourself must understand.
He was flying past the turtle now. And even at his tremendous skidding speed, the turtle's plated side seemed to go on and on to his right. He thought dimly of riding in a train and passing one going in the other direction, a train that was so long it seemed eventually to stand still or even move backward. He could still hear it, yammering and buzzing, its voice high and angry, not human, full of mad hate. But when the turtle spoke, its voice was blanked out utterly. The turtle spoke in Bill's head, and Bill understood somehow that there was yet another, and that final other dwelt in a void beyond this one.
This final other was, perhaps, the creator of the turtle, which only watched, and it, which only ate. This other was a force beyond the universe, a power beyond all other power, the author of all there was. Suddenly he thought he understood. It meant to thrust him through some wall at the end of the universe and into some other place, what that old turtle called the macroverse, where it really lived, where it existed as a titanic, glowing core, which might be no more than the smallest mote in that other's mind. He would see it naked, a thing of unshaped, destroying light, and there he would either be mercifully annihilated or live forever, insane and yet conscious inside its homicidal, endless, formless, hungry being. Please help me! For the others!
You must help yourself, son.
But how? Please tell me! How? 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 He had reached the turtle's heavily scaled back legs now. There was time enough to observe its titanic, yet ancient flesh, time to be struck with the wonder of its heavy toenails. They were an odd bluish-yellow color, and he could see galaxies swimming in each one. Please, you are good. I sense and believe that you are good, and I am begging you. Won't you please help me?
You already know. There is only Chud and your friends.
Please! Oh, please!
Son, you've got to thrust your fists against the posts and still insist you see the ghosts. That's all I can tell you. Once you get into cosmological shit like this, you got to throw away the instruction manual. He realized the voice of the turtle was fading. He was beyond it now, bulleting into a darkness that was deeper than deep. The turtle's voice was being overcome, overmastered by the gleeful, gibbering voice of the thing that had thrust him out and into this black void, the voice of the spider, of it.
How do you like it out here, little friend? Do you like it? Do you love it? Do you give it 98 points because it has a good beat and you can dance to it? Can you catch it on your tonsils and heave it left and right? Did you enjoy meeting my friend, the turtle? I thought that stupid old fuck died years ago, and for all the good he could do you, he might as well have. Did you think he could help you?
No. He thrusts.
No, stop babbling. The time is short. Let us talk while we still can. Tell me about yourself, little friend. Tell me, do you love all the cold dark out here? Are you enjoying your grand tour of the nothingness that lies outside? Wait until you break through, little friend. Wait until you break through to where I am. Wait for that. Wait for the deadlights. You'll look and you'll go mad. But you'll live and live and live inside them. Inside me.
It screamed noxious laughter, and Bill became aware that its voice was beginning both to fade and to swell, as if he was simultaneously drawing out of its range and hurtling into it. And wasn't that just what was happening? Yes, he thought it was, because while the voices were in perfect sync, the one he was now rushing toward was totally alien, speaking syllables no human tongue or throat could reproduce. That's the voice of the deadlights, he thought.
The time is short. Let us talk while we still can.
Its human voice fading the way the Bangor radio stations faded when you were in the car and traveling south. Bright, flaring terror filled him. He would shortly be beyond sane communication with it. And some part of him understood that. For all its laughter, for all its alien glee, that was what it wanted. Not just to send him out to whatever it really was, but to break their mental communication. If that ceased, he would be utterly destroyed. To pass beyond communication was to pass beyond salvation. He understood that much from the way his parents had behaved toward him after George had died. It was the only lesson their refrigerator coldness had had to teach him. leaving it, and approaching it. But the leaving was somehow more important. If it wanted to eat little kids out here, or suck them in, or whatever it did, why hadn't it sent them all out here? Why just him? Because it had to rid its spider self of him, that was why. Somehow the spider it and the it which it called the deadlights were linked. Whatever lived out here in the black might be invulnerable when it was here and nowhere else. But it was also on Earth, under Derry, in a form that was physical. However repulsive it might be, in Derry it was physical. And what was physical could be killed. Bill skidded through the dark, his speed still increasing. Why do I sense so much of its talk is nothing but a bluff, a big shuck and jive? Why should that be? How can that be? He understood how, maybe, just maybe. There is only Chud, the turtle had said. And suppose this was it. Suppose they had bitten deep into each other's tongues, not physically, but mentally, spiritually. And suppose that if it could throw Bill far enough into the void, far enough toward its eternal discorporate self, the ritual would be over. It would have ripped him free, killed him, and won everything all at the same time. You're doing good, son. But very shortly it's going to be too late. It's scared! Scared of me! Scared of all of us! Skidding. He was skidding. And there was a wall up ahead. He sensed it in the dark. The wall at the edge of the continuum. And beyond it, the other shape. The deadlights! Don't talk to me, son. And don't talk to yourself. It's tearing you loose. Bite in if you care, if you dare, if you can be brave, if you can stand. Bite in, son. Bill bit in. Not with his teeth, but with teeth in his mind. Dropping his voice a full register, making it not his own, making it, in fact, his father's voice. Although Bill would go to his grave not knowing this, some secrets are never known, and it's probably better so. Drawing in a great breath, he cried, "He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. Now let me go!" He felt it scream in his mind, a scream of frustrated, petulant rage. But it was also a scream of fear and pain. It was not used to not having its own way. Such a thing had never happened to it, and until the most recent moments of its existence, it had not suspected such a thing could. Bill felt it writhing at him, not pulling, but pushing, trying to get him away. "Thrusts its fists against the posts," I said. "Stop it! Bring me back! You must! I command it! I demand it!" It screamed again, its pain more intense now, perhaps partly because, while it had spent its long, long existence inflicting pain, feeding on it, it had never experienced it as a part of itself. Still, it tried to push him, to get rid of him, blindly and stubbornly insisting on winning, as it had always won before. It pushed! But Bill sensed that his outward speed had slowed, and a grotesque image came into his mind. Its tongue, covered with that living spittle, extended like a thick rubber band, cracking, bleeding. He saw himself clinging to the tip of that tongue by his teeth, ripping through it a little at a time, his face bathed in the convulsive ichor that was its blood, drowning in its dead stench, yet still holding on somehow, while it struggled in its blind pain and towering rage not to let its tongue snap back.
Chud. This Chud. Stand. Be brave. Be true. Stand for your brother, your friends. Believe. Believe in all the things you have believed in. Believe that if you tell the policeman you're lost, he'll see that you get home safely. That there is a tooth fairy who lives in a huge enamel castle, and Santa Claus below the North Pole, making toys with his trove of elves, and that Captain Midnight could be real, yes, he could be, in spite of Calvin and Sissy Clark's big brother Carlton saying that was all a lot of baby stuff,
Believe that your mother and father will love you again, that courage is possible, and words will come smoothly every time. No more losers. No more cowering in a hole in the ground and calling it a clubhouse. No more crying in Georgie's room because you couldn't save him and didn't know. Believe in yourself. Believe in the heat of that desire. He suddenly began to laugh in the darkness, not in hysteria, but in utter, delighted amazement. Oh, shit! I believe in all of those things! He shouted. And it was true. Even at 11, he had observed that things turned out right a ridiculous amount of the time. Light flared around him. He raised his arms out and above his head. He turned his face up, and suddenly he felt power rush through him. He heard it scream again. And suddenly, he was being drawn back the way he had come, still holding that image of his teeth planted deep in the strange meat of its tongue, his teeth locked together like grim old death. He flew through the dark, legs trailing behind him, the tips of his mud-crusted sneaker laces flying like pennants, the wind of this empty place blowing in his ears. He was pulled past the turtle and saw that its head had withdrawn into its shell. Its voice emerged hollow and distorted, as if even the shell it lived in were a well eternities deep. Not bad, son, but I'd finish it now. Don't let it get away. Energy has a way of dissipating, you know. What can be done when you're 11 can often never be done again. The voice of the turtle faded, faded. Faded. There was only the rushing dark, and then the mouth of a cyclopean tunnel. Smells of age and decay, cobwebs brushing at his face like rotted skeins of silk in a haunted house. Moldering tiles blurring by, intersections all dark now, the moon balloons all gone, and it was screaming, screaming, "Let me go! Let me go! I'll leave, never come back! Let me go! It hurts! It hurts! It hurts!" "Thrusts his fists!" Bill screamed, nearly delirious now. He could see light ahead, but it was fading, guttering like great candles which had at last burned low. And for a moment, he saw himself and the others holding hands in a line, Eddie on one side of him and Richie on the other. He saw his own body sagging, his head rolled back on his neck, staring up at the spider, which twisted and whirled like a dervish, its coarse, spiny legs beating at the floor, poison dripping from its stinger. It was screaming in its death agony. So Bill honestly believed. Then he was slamming back into his body with all the impact of a line drive slamming into a baseball glove, the force of it tearing his hands loose from Richie's and Eddie's, driving him to his knees and skidding him across the floor to the edge of the web. He reached out for one of the strands without thinking, and his hand immediately went numb as if it had been injected with a hypo full of Novocaine. The strand itself was as thick as a telephone pole guy wire. "Don't touch that, Bill!" Ben yelled, and Bill yanked his hand away in one quick jerk, leaving a raw place across his palm just below the fingers. It filled with blood, and he staggered to his feet, eyes on the spider. It was scrabbling away from them, making its way into the growing dimness at the back of the chamber as the light failed. It left puddles and pools of black blood behind as it went. Somehow their confrontation had ruptured its insides in a dozen, maybe 100 places. "Bill, the web!" Mike screamed. "Look out!" He stepped backward, craning his neck up, as strands of its web came floating down, striking the stone-flagged floor on either side of him like the bodies of meaty white snakes. They immediately began to lose shape, to flow into the cracks between the stones. The web was falling apart, coming loose from its many moorings. One of the bodies, wrapped up like a fly, came plunging down to strike the floor with a sickening, rotted gourd sound. "The spider!" Bill yelled. "Where is it?" He could still hear it in his head, mewling and crying out in its pain, and understood dimly that it had gone into the same tunnel it had thrown Bill into. But had it gone in there to flee back to the place where it had meant to send Bill? Or to hide until they were gone? To die? Or escape? "Christ, the lights!" Richie shouted. "The lights are going out! What happened, Bill? Where did you go? We thought you were dead!" In some confused part of his mind, Bill knew that wasn't true. If they had really thought him dead, they would have run, scattered, and it would have picked them off easily, one by one, Or perhaps it would be truer to say that they had thought him dead, but believed him alive. We have to make sure. If it's dying or gone back to where it came from, where the rest of it is, that's fine. But what if it's just hurt? What if it can get better? What? Stan's shriek cut across his thoughts like broken glass. In the fading light, Bill saw that one of the strands of webbing had come down on Stan's shoulder. Before Bill could reach him, Mike had thrown himself at the smaller boy in a flying tackle. He drove Stan away, and the piece of webbing snapped back, taking a piece of Stan's polo shirt with it. "Get back!" Ben yelled at them. "Get away from it! It's all coming down!" He seized Beverly's hand and pulled her back toward the child-sized door, while Stan struggled to his feet, looked dazedly around, and then grabbed Eddie. The two of them started toward Ben and Beverly, helping each other, looking like phantoms in the fading light. Overhead, the spiderweb was drooping, collapsing on itself, losing its fearful symmetry. Bodies twirled lazily in the air, like nightmarish plum bobs. Cross strands fell in like the rotted rungs of some strange complex of ladders. Severed strands hit the stone flagging, hissed like cats, lost their shape, began to run. Mike Hanlon wove his way through them, as he would later weave his way through the opposing lines of nearly a dozen high school football teams, head down, ducking and dodging. Richie joined him. Incredibly, Richie was laughing, although his hair was standing straight up on his head like the quills of a porcupine. The light grew dimmer, the phosphorescence that had coiled on the walls now dying away. "Bill!" Mike shouted. "Come on! Get the frock out of there!" "What if it's not dead?" Bill screamed back. "We got to go after it, Mike! We got to make sure!" A snarl of webbing sagged outward like a parachute and then fell with a nasty ripping sound that was like skin being pulled apart. Mike grabbed Bill's arm and pulled him, stumbling out of the way. "It's dead!" Eddie cried, joining them. His eyes were febrile lamps, his breathing a chilly winter whistle in his throat. Fallen strands of webbing had sizzled complex scars into the plaster of Paris of his cast. "I heard it. It was dying. You don't sound like that. If you're on your way to a sock hop, it was dying. I'm sure of it." Richie's hands groped out of the darkness, seized Bill, and pulled him into a rough embrace. He began to pound Bill's back ecstatically. "I heard it, too. It was dying, Big Bill. It was dying. And you're not stuttering. Not at all. How'd you do it? How in the hell?" Bill's brain was whirling. Exhaustion tugged at him with thick and clumsy hands. He could not remember ever feeling this tired. But in his mind, he heard the drawling, almost weary voice of the turtle. "I'd finish it now. Don't let it get away. What can be done when you're 11 can often never be done again." "But we have to be sure." The shadows were joining hands. And now the darkness was almost complete. But before the light failed utterly, he thought he saw the same hellish doubt on Beverly's face and in Stan's eyes. And still, as the last of the light gave way, they could hear the tenebrous whisper-shudder thump of its unspeakable web falling to pieces. 3. Bill in the Void. Late.
"Well, here you are again, little buddy. But what's happened to your hair? You're just as bald as a cue ball. Sad. What sad short lives humans live. Each life a short pamphlet written by an idiot. Tut, tut, and all that."
"I'm still Bill Denbro. You killed my brother and you killed Stan the man. You tried to kill Mike. And I'm going to tell you something. This time, I'm not going to stop until the job's done."
"The turtle was stupid, too stupid to lie. He told you the truth, little buddy. The time only comes around once. You hurt me. You surprised me. Never again. I am the one who called you back.
You called all right, but you weren't the only one.
Your friend the turtle, he died a few years ago. The old idiot puked inside his shell and choked to death on a galaxy or two. Very sad, don't you think? But also quite bizarre. Deserves a place in Ripley's Believe It or Not. That's what I think. Happened right around the same time you had that writer's block. You must have felt him go, little buddy."
I don't believe that either.
Oh, you'll believe. You'll see. This time, little buddy, I intend you to see everything, including the deadlights.
He sensed its voice rising, buzzing and racketing. At last he sensed the full extent of its fury, and he was terrified. He reached for the tongue of its mind, concentrating, trying desperately to recapture the full extent of that childish belief, understanding at the same time that there was a deadly truth in what it had said. Last time, it had been unprepared. This time, well, even if it had not been the only one to call them, it sure had been waiting. But still, he felt his own fury clean and singing as his eyes fixed on its eyes. He sensed its old scars, sensed that it had truly been hurt, and that it was still hurt. And as it threw him, as he felt his mind swatted out of his body, he concentrated all of his being on seizing its tongue and missed his grip.
4.
Richie. The other four watched, paralyzed. It was an exact replay of what had happened before. At first, the spider, which seemed about to seize Bill and gobble him up, grew suddenly still. Bill's eyes locked with its ruby ones. There was a sense of contact, a contact just beyond their ability to divine. But they felt the struggle, the clash of wills. Then Richie glanced up into the new web and saw the first difference. There were bodies there, some half-eaten and half-rotted, and that was the same. But high up in one corner was another body, and Richie was sure this one was still fresh, possibly even still alive. Beverly had not looked up, her eyes were fixed on Bill and the spider. But even in his terror, Richie saw the resemblance between Beverly and the woman in the web. Her hair was long and red, her eyes were open but glassy and unmoving. A line of spittle had run from the left corner of her mouth down to her chin. She had been attached to one of the web's main cables by a gossamer harness that went around her waist and under both arms, so that she lolled forward in a half bow, arms and legs dangling limply. Her feet were bare. Richie saw another body crumpled at the foot of her web, a man he had never seen before. And yet his mind registered an almost subconscious resemblance to the late unlamented Henry Bowers. Blood had run from both of the stranger's eyes and caked in a foam around his mouth and on his chin. Then Beverly was screaming, "Something's wrong! Something's gone wrong! Do something, for Christ's sake! Won't somebody do something?" Richie's gaze snapped back to Bill and the spider, and he sensed, heard, monstrous laughter. Bill's face was stretching in some subtle way. His skin had gone parchment sallow, as shiny as the skin of a very old person. His eyes were rolled up to the whites. "Oh, Bill, where are you?" As Richie watched, blood suddenly burst from Bill's nose in a foam. His mouth was writhing, trying to scream, and now the spider was advancing on him again. It was turning, presenting its stinger. "It means to kill him. Kill his body, anyway. While his mind is somewhere else, it means to shut him out forever. It's winning. Bill, where are you? For Christ's sake, where are you?" And somewhere, faintly from some unimaginable distance, he heard Bill scream. And the words, although meaningless, were crystal clear and full of sickening, "The turtle is dead. Oh God, the turtle really is dead." Despair. Bev shrieked again and put her hands to her ears as if to shut out that fading voice. The spider's stinger rose, and Richie bolted at it, a grin spreading up toward his ears, and he called out in his best Irish cop's voice, "Here, here, me fine girl, just what in the hell do you think you're doing? Belay that goff before I snatch your petty skirts and snap your smithy riddles!" The spider stopped laughing, and Richie felt a rising howl of anger and pain inside its head. "Hurt it!" he thought triumphantly. "Hurt it! How about that? Hurt it! And guess what? I've got its tongue! I think Bill missed it somehow, but while it was distracted, I got—" Then screaming at him, its cries, a hive of furious bees in his head, Richie was whacked out of himself and into darkness, dimly aware that it was trying to shake him loose. It was doing a pretty good job, too.
Terror washed through him, and then was replaced by a sense of cosmic absurdity. He remembered Beverly with his Duncan yo-yo, showing him how to make it sleep, walk the dog, go around the world. And now here he was, Richie the human yo-yo, and its tongue was the string. Here he was, and this wasn't called walking the dog, but maybe walking the spider. And if that wasn't funny, what was? Richie laughed. It wasn't polite to laugh with your mouth full, of course, but he doubted if anybody out here read Miss Manners. That got him laughing again, and he bit in harder. The spider screamed and shook him furiously, howling its anger at being surprised again. It had believed only the writer would challenge it, and now this man who was laughing like a crazy boy had seized it when it was least prepared. Richie felt himself slipping.
"Hold it a second, senorita. We's going out here together, or I ain't gonna sell you no tickets in La Loteria after all, and everyone is a big wiener, I swear on my mama's name!"
He felt his teeth catch again, more firmly this time, and there was a fainting sort of pain as it drove its fangs into his own tongue. Boy, it was still pretty funny, though. Even in the dark, being hurled after Bill, with only the tongue of this unspeakable monster left to connect him to his own world, even with the pain of its poisonous fangs suffusing his mind like a red fog, it was pretty goddamn funny. Check it out, folks! You'll believe a disc jockey can fly! He was flying, all right. Richie was in greater darkness than he had ever known, than he had ever suspected might exist, traveling at what felt like the speed of light and being shaken as a terrier shakes a rat. He sensed that there was something up ahead, some titanic corpse. The turtle he had heard Bill lamenting in his fading voice? Must be. It was only a shell, a dead husk. Then he was past, rushing on into the darkness. Really steaming now, he thought, and felt that wild urge to cackle again. Bill! Bill, can you hear me?
He's gone! He's in the deadlights! Let me go! Let me go!
Richie? Incredibly distant, incredibly far out in the black. Bill! Bill! Here I am! Catch hold, for God's sake! Catch hold!
He's dead. You're all dead. You're too old. Don't you understand that? Now let me go!
Hey, bitch! You're never too old to rock and roll!
Let me go!
Take me to him and maybe I will! Richie, closer. He was closer now. Thank God! Here I come, Big Bill! Richie to the rescue! Gonna save your old cracked ass! Oh, you won from that day on Niebold Street, remember?
Let me go!
It was hurting badly now, and Richie understood how completely he had caught it by surprise. It had believed. It had only Bill to deal with. Well, good. Good enough. Richie didn't care about killing it right now. He was no longer sure it could be killed. But Bill could be killed. And Richie sensed that Bill's time was now very, very short. Bill was closing in on some large, nasty surprise out here, something best not thought about. Richie, no. Go back. It's the edge of everything up here. The deadlights.
Sounds like what you turn on when you're driving your horse at midnight, senor.
Where is you, honey child? Smile so I can see where you is.
And suddenly, Bill was there, skidding along on the left, right? There was no direction here. One side or the other. And beyond him, coming up fast, Richie could see, sense, something that finally dried up his laughter. It was a barrier, something of a strange, non-geometrical shape that his mind could not grasp. Instead, his mind translated it as best it could, as it had translated the shape of it into a spider, allowing Richie to think of it as a colossal gray wall made of fossilized wooden stakes. These stakes went forever up and forever down, like the bars of a cage, and from between them shone a great blind light. It glared and moved, smiled and snarled. The light was alive. Deadlights. More than alive. It was full of a force, magnetism, gravity, perhaps something else. Richie felt himself lifted and dropped, swirled and pulled, as if he were shooting a fast throat of rapids in an inner tube. He could feel the light moving eagerly over his face, and the light was thinking. This is it. This is it. The rest of it.
Let me go. You promised to let me go.
I know, but sometimes, honey child, I lie. My mama, she beat me for it, but my daddy, he done just about give up.
He sensed Bill tumbling and flailing toward one of the gaps in the wall, sensed evil fingers of light reaching for him, and, with a final despairing effort, he reached for his friend. Bill! Your hand! Give me your hand! Your hand, goddammit, your hand! Bill's hand shot out, the fingers opening and closing, that living fire crawling and twisting over Audra's wedding ring in runic, Moorish patterns, wheels, crescents, stars, swastikas, linked circles that grew into rolling chains. Bill's face was overlaid with the same light, making him look tattooed. Richie stretched out as far as he could, hearing it scream and yammer. I missed him! Oh, dear God, I missed! He's gonna shoot through! Then Bill's fingers closed over Richie's, and Richie clenched his hand into a fist. Bill's legs flew through one of the gaps in the frozen wood, and for one mad moment Richie realized he could see all the bones and veins and capillaries inside them, as if Bill had shot halfway into the maw of the world's strongest X-ray machine. Richie felt the muscles in his arm stretch like taffy, felt the ball and socket joint in his shoulder creak and groan in protest as the foot-pounds of pressure built up. He summoned all of his force and shouted, "Pull us back! Pull us back or I'll kill you! I'll voice you to death!" The spider screeched again, and Richie suddenly felt a great snapping whiplash curl through his body. His arm was a white-hot bar of agony. His grip on Bill's hand began to slip. "Hold on, Big Bill! I got you! Richie, I got you! You better!" Richie thought grimly, because I think you could walk 10 billion miles out here and never find a fucking pay toilet. They whistled back, that crazy light fading, becoming a series of brilliant pinpoints that finally winked out. They drove through the darkness like torpedoes, Richie gripping its tongue with his teeth and Bill's wrist with one aching hand. There was the turtle, there and gone in a single eye blink. Richie sensed them drawing closer to whatever passed for the real world, although he believed he would never think of it as exactly real again. He would see it as a clever canvas scene underlaid with a crisscrossing of support cables, cables like the strands of a spider web. "But we're going to be all right," he thought. "We're going to get back. We..." The buffeting began then, the whipping, slamming, side-to-side flailing, as it tried one final time to shake them off and leave them outside. And Richie felt his grip slipping. He heard its guttural roar of triumph and concentrated his being on holding, but he continued to slip. He bit down frantically, but its tongue seemed to be losing substance and reality. It seemed to be becoming gossamer. "Help!" Richie screamed. "I'm losing it! Help! Somebody help us!"
5. Eddie.
Eddie was half aware of what was happening. He felt it somehow, saw it somehow, but as if through a gauzy curtain. Somewhere, Bill and Richie were struggling to come back. Their bodies were here, but the rest of them, the real of them, was far away. He had seen the spider turn to impale Bill with its stinger, and then Richie had run forward, yelling at it in that ridiculous Irish cop's voice he used to use. Only Richie must have improved his act a hell of a lot over the years, because this voice sounded eerily like Mr. Nell from the old days. The spider had turned toward Richie, and Eddie had seen its unspeakable red eyes bulge in their sockets. Richie yelled again, this time in his Pancho Vanilla voice, and Eddie had felt the spider scream in pain. Ben yelled hoarsely, as a split appeared in its hide along the line of one of its scars from the last time. A stream of ichor, black as crude oil, sprayed out. Richie had started to say something else, and his voice had begun to diminish, like the fade at the end of a pop song. His head had rolled back on his neck, his eyes fixed on its eyes. The spider grew quiet again. Time passed. Eddie had no idea just how much. Richie and the spider stared at each other. Eddie sensed the connection between them, felt a swirl of talk and emotion somewhere far away. He could make out nothing exactly, but sensed the tones of things in colors and hues. Bill lay slumped on the floor, nose and ears bleeding, fingers twitching slightly, his long face pale, his eyes closed. The spider was now bleeding in 4 or 5 places, badly hurt again, badly hurt but still dangerously vital. And Eddie thought, why are we just standing around here? We could hurt it while it's occupied with Richie. Why doesn't somebody move, for Christ's sake? He sensed a wild triumph. And that feeling was clearer, sharper, closer. They're coming back, he wanted to shout. But his mouth was too dry, his throat too tight.
They're coming back!
Then Richie's head began to turn slowly from side to side. His body seemed to ripple inside his clothes. His glasses hung on the end of his nose for a moment, then fell off and shattered on the stone floor. The spider stirred, its spiny legs making a dry clittering on the floor. Eddie heard it cry out in terrible triumph, and a moment later Richie's voice burst clearly into his head. Help! I'm losing it! Somebody help me! Eddie ran forward then, yanking his aspirator from his pocket with his good hand, his lips drawn back in a grimace, his breath whistling painfully in and out of a throat that now felt the size of a pinhole. Crazily! His mother's face danced before him, and she was crying, "Don't go near that thing, Eddie! Don't go near it! Things like that give you cancer!" "Shut up, Ma!" Eddie screamed in a high, shrieky voice, all the voice he had left. The spider's head turned toward the sound, its eyes momentarily leaving Richie's. "Here!" Eddie howled in his fading voice. "Here! Have some of this!" He leaped at it, triggering the aspirator at the same time, and for an instant, all his childhood belief in the medicine came back to him, the childhood medicine that could solve everything, that could make him feel better when the bigger boys roughed him up, or when he was knocked over in the rush to get through the doors when school let out, or when he had to sit on the edge of the Tracker Brothers' vacant lot out of the game because his mother wouldn't allow him to play baseball. It was good medicine, strong medicine, and as he leaped into the spider's face, smelling its foul yellow stench, feeling himself overwhelmed by its single-minded fury and determination to wipe them all out, he triggered the aspirator into one of its ruby eyes. He felt, heard its scream. No rage this time, only pain, a horrid, screaming agony. He saw the mist of droplets settle on that blood-red bulge, saw the droplets turn white where they landed, saw them sink in as a splash of carbolic acid would sink in. He saw its huge eye begin to flatten out like a bloody egg yolk and run in a ghastly stream of living blood and ichor and maggoty pus. "Come home now, Bill!" he screamed with the last of his voice. And then he struck it. He felt its noisome heat baking into him. He felt a terrible wet warmth and realized that his good arm had slipped into the spider's mouth. He triggered the aspirator again, shooting the stuff right down its throat this time, right down its rotten, evil, stinking gullet. And there was sudden, flashing pain, as clean as the drop of a heavy knife, as its jaws closed and ripped his arm off at the shoulder. Eddie fell to the floor, the ragged stump of his arm spraying blood, faintly aware that Bill was getting shakily to his feet, that Richie was weaving and stumbling toward him like a drunk at the end of a long, hard night. Ed's! Far away. Unimportant. He could feel everything running out of him along with his life's blood, all the rage, all the pain, all the fear, all the confusion and hurt. He supposed he was dying, but he felt... Ah, God. He felt so lucid, so clear, like a window pane which has been washed clean and now lets in all the gloriously frightening light of some unsuspected dawning. The light, oh God, that perfect, rational light that clears the horizon somewhere in the world every second. Ed's, oh my God, Bill, Ben, someone, he's lost his arm, his... He looked up at Beverly and saw she was crying, the tears coursing down her dirty cheeks as she got an arm under him. He became aware that she had taken off her blouse and was trying to staunch the flow of blood, and that she was screaming for help. Then he looked at Richie and licked his lips, fading back, becoming clearer and clearer, emptying out all of the impurities flowing out of him so he could become clear, so that the light could flow through. And if he had had time enough, he could have preached on this. He could have sermonized. "Not bad," he would begin. "This is not bad at all." But there was something else he had to say first. "Richie," he whispered.
"What?"
Richie was down on his hands and knees, staring at him desperately. "Don't call me Ed's," he said, and smiled. He raised his left hand slowly and touched Richie's cheek. Richie was crying. "You know, I... Eddie closed his eyes, thinking how to finish, and while he was still thinking it over, he died. 6. Derry, 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock a.m. By 7 a.m., the wind speed in Derry had picked up to about 37 miles an hour, with gusts up to 45. Harry Brooks, a National Weather Service forecaster based at Bangor International Airport, made an alarmed call to NWS headquarters in Augusta. The winds, he said, were coming out of the west and blowing in a queer semicircular pattern he had never seen before, but it looked to him more and more like some weird species of pocket hurricane, one that was limited almost exclusively to Derry Township. At 7:10, the major Bangor radio stations broadcast the first severe weather warnings. The explosion of the power transformer at Tracker Brothers had killed the power all over Derry on the Kansas Street side of the Barrens. At 7:17, a hoary old maple on the old Cape side of the Barrens fell with a terrific rending crash, flattening a night owl store on the corner of Merritt Street and Cape Avenue. An elderly patron named Raymond Fogarty was killed by a toppling beer cooler. This was the same Raymond Fogarty who, as the minister of the First Methodist Church of Derry, had presided over the burial rites of George Denbrough in October of 1957. The maple also pulled down enough power lines to knock out the power in both the Old Cape and the somewhat more fashionable Sherburne Woods development beyond it. The clock in the steeple of the Grace Baptist Church had chimed neither 6 nor 7. At 7:20, 3 minutes after the maple fell in the Old Cape, and about 1 hour and 15 minutes after every toilet and domestic drain over there had suddenly reversed itself, the clock in the tower chimed 13 times. A minute later, a blue-white stroke of lightning struck the steeple. Heather Libby, the minister's wife, happened to be looking out the window of the parsonage's kitchen at the time, and she said that the steeple exploded like someone loaded it up with dynamite. Whitewashed boards, chunks of beams, and clockwork from Switzerland showered down on the street. The ragged remains of the steeple burned briefly and then guttered out in the rain, which was now a tropical downpour. The streets leading downhill into the downtown shopping area foamed and ran. The progress of the canal under Main Street had become a steady, shaking thunder that made people look at each other uneasily. At 7:25, with the titanic crash of the Grace Baptist steeple still reverberating all over Derry, the janitor who came into Wally's Spa every morning except Sunday to swamp the place out saw something which sent him screaming into the street. This fellow, who had been an alcoholic ever since his first semester at the University of Maine, lo, these 11 years ago, was paid a pittance for his services. His real pay, it was understood, was his absolute freedom to finish up anything left in the beer kegs under the bar from the night before. Richie Tozier might or might not have remembered him. He was Vincent Caruso Taliendo, better known to his fifth-grade contemporaries as Boogers Taliendo. As he was mopping up on that apocalyptic morning in Derry, working his way gradually closer and closer to the serving area, he saw all 7 of the beer taps, 3 Bud, 2 Narragansett, 1 Schlitz, known more familiarly to the bleary patrons of Wally's as Slits, and 1 Miller Lite, nod forward as if pulled by 7 invisible hands. Beer ran from them in streams of gold-white foam. Vince started forward, thinking not of ghosts or phantoms, but of his morning's dividend going down the drain. Then he skidded to a stop, eyes widening, and a wailing, horrified scream rose in the empty, beer-smelling cave that was Wally's Spa. Beer had given way to arterial streams of blood. It swirled in the chromium drains, overflowed, and ran down the side of the bar in little streamlets. Now hair and chunks of flesh began to splurt out of the beer taps. Boogers Taliendo watched this, transfixed, not even able to summon enough strength to scream again. Then there was a thudding, toneless blast, as one of the beer kegs under the counter exploded. All of the cupboard doors under the bar swung wide. Greenish smoke, like the aftermath of a magician's trick, began to drift out of them. Boogers had seen enough. Screaming, he fled into the street, which was now a shallow canal. He fell on his butt, got up, and threw a terrified glance back over his shoulder. One of the bar windows blew out with a loud shooting gallery sound. Wickers of broken glass whistled all around Vince's head. A moment later, the other window exploded. Once again, he was miraculously untouched. But he decided on the spur of the moment that the time had come to see his sister up Eastport. He started off at once, and his journey to the Derry town limits and beyond would make a saga in itself, but suffice it to say that he did eventually get out of town. Others were not so lucky. Aloysius Nell, who had turned 77 not long since, was sitting with his wife in the parlor of their home on Strapham Street, watching the storm pound Derry. At 7:32, he suffered a fatal stroke. His wife told her brother a week later that Aloysius dropped his coffee cup on the rug, sat bolt upright, his eyes wide and staring, and screamed,
"Hear, hear, me fine girl! Just what in the hell do you think you're doing? Belay that guff before I snatch your petty skirr!"
Then he fell out of his chair, smashing his coffee cup under him. Maureen Nell, who knew well how bad his ticker had been for the last 3 years, understood immediately that all was over with him, and after loosening his collar, she had run for the telephone to call Father McDowell. But the phone was out of order. A funny noise like a police siren was all it would make. And so, although she knew it was probably a blasphemy she would have to answer for to St. Peter, she had attempted to give him the last rites herself. She felt confident, she told her brother, that God would understand even if St. Peter didn't. Aloysius had been a good husband and a good man, and if he drank too much, that was only the Irish in him coming out. At 7:49, a series of explosions shook the Derry Mall, which stood on the site of the defunct Kitchener Ironworks. No one was killed. The mall didn't open until 10 o'clock, and the 5-man janitorial squad hadn't been due to arrive until 8 o'clock, and on such a morning as this, very few of them would have shown up anyway. A team of investigators later dismissed the idea of sabotage. They suggested, rather vaguely, that the explosions had probably been caused by water which had seeped into the mall's electrical system. Whatever the reason, no one was going to go shopping at the Derry Mall for a long time. One explosion totally wiped out Zale's jewelry store. Diamond rings, ID bracelets, strings of pearls, trays of wedding rings, and Seiko digital watches flew everywhere in a hail of bright, sparkly trinkets. A music box flew the length of the East Corridor and landed in the fountain outside of the J.C. Penney's, where it briefly played a bubbly rendition of the theme from Love Story before shutting down. The same blast tore a hole through the Baskin-Robbins next door, turning the 31 flavors into ice cream soup that ran away along the floor in cloudy runnels. The blast which tore through Sears lifted off a chunk of the roof, and the rising wind sailed it away like a kite. It came down 1,000 yards away, slicing cleanly through the silo of a farmer named Brent Kilgallen. Kilgallen's 16-year-old son rushed out with his mother's Kodak and took a picture. The National Enquirer bought it for $60, which the boy used to buy 2 new tires for his Yamaha motorcycle. A third explosion ripped through Hit or Miss, sending flaming skirts, jeans, and underwear out into the flooded parking lot. And a final explosion tore open the mall branch of the Derry Farmers Trust like a rotted box of crackers. A chunk of the bank's roof was also torn off. Burglar alarms went off with a bray that would not be silenced until the security system's independent wiring hookup was shorted out 4 hours later. Loan contracts, banking instruments, deposit slips, cash drawer chits, and money manager forms were lifted into the sky and blown away by the rising wind. And money. Tens and twenties, mostly. With a generous helping of fives and a soupçon of fifties and hundreds. Better than $75,000 blew away, according to the bank's officers. Later, after a mass shake-up in the bank's executive structure and an FSLIC bailout, some would admit, strictly off the record, of course, that it had been more like $200,000. A woman in Haven Village named Rebecca Paulson found a $50 bill fluttering from her back-door welcome mat, 2 twenties in her birdhouse, and 100 plastered against an oak tree in her backyard. She and her husband used the money to make an extra 2 payments on their Bombardier Skidoo. Dr. Hale, a retired doctor who had lived on West Broadway for nearly 50 years, was killed at 8 a.m. Dr. Hale liked to boast that he had taken the same 2-mile walk from his West Broadway home and around Derry Park and the elementary school for the last 25 of those 50 years. Nothing stopped him, not rain, sleet, hail, howling nor'easters, or sub-zero cold. He set out on the morning of May 31st in spite of his housekeeper's worried fussings. His exit line from the world, spoken back over his shoulder as he went through the front door, pulling his hat firmly down to his ears, was,
"Don't be so goddamn silly, Hilda. This is nothing but a capful of rain. You should have seen it in 57. That was a storm."
As Dr. Hale turned back onto West Broadway, a manhole cover in front of the Muller place suddenly lifted off like the payload of a redstone rocket. It decapitated the good doctor so quickly and neatly that he walked on another 3 steps before collapsing dead on the sidewalk. And the wind continued to rise. 7. Under the City, 4:15 p.m. Eddie led them through the darkened tunnels for an hour, perhaps an hour and a half, before admitting, in a tone that was more bewildered than frightened, that for the first time in his life, he was lost. They could still hear the dim thunder of water in the drains, but the acoustics of all these tunnels was so crazed that it was impossible to tell if the water sounds were coming from ahead or behind, left or right, above or below. Their matches were gone. They were lost in the dark. Bill was scared, plenty scared. The conversation he'd had with his father in his father's shop kept coming back to him. There's 9 pounds of blueprints that just disappeared somewhere along the line. My point is that nobody knows where all the damned sewers and drains go or why. When they work, nobody cares. When they don't, there's 3 or 4 sad sacks from Derry Water who have to try and find out which pump went fluey or where the plug-up is. It's dark and smelly, and there are rats. Those are all good reasons to stay out, but the best reason is that you can get lost. It's happened before. Happened before. Happened before. It's happened. Sure it had. There was that bundle of bones and polished cotton they had passed on the way to its lair, for instance. Bill felt panic, trying to rise, and pushed it back. It went, but not easily. He could feel it back there, a live thing, struggling and twisting, trying to get out. Adding to it was the nagging, unanswerable question of whether they had killed it or not. Richie said yes, Mike said yes, so did Eddie. But he hadn't liked the frightened, doubtful look on Bev's face, or on Stan's, as the light died and they crawled back through the small door, away from the susurrating, collapsing web. "So what do we do now?" Stan asked. Bill heard the frightened little boy tremble in Stan's voice, and knew the question was aimed directly at him. "Yeah," Ben said. "What? Damn, I wish we had a flashlight or even a candle. Bill thought he heard a stifled sob in the second ellipsis. It frightened him more than anything else. Ben would have been astounded to know it, but Bill thought the fat boy tough and resourceful, steadier than Richie, and less apt to cave in suddenly than Stan. If Ben was getting ready to crack, they were on the edge of very bad trouble. It was not the skeleton of the water department guy to which Bill's own mind kept returning, but to Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher, lost in McDougal's cave. He would push the thought away, and then it would come stealing back. Something else was troubling him, but the concept was too large and too vague for his tired boy's mind to grasp. Perhaps it was the very simplicity of the idea that made it elusive. They were falling away from each other. The bond that had held them all this long summer was dissolving. It had been faced and vanquished. It might be dead, as Richie and Eddie thought, or it might be wounded so badly it would sleep for 100 years, or 1,000, or 10,000. They had faced it, seen it with its final mask laid aside, and it had been horrible enough, oh, for sure. But once seen, its physical form was not so bad, and its most potent weapon was taken away from it. They all had, after all, seen spiders before. They were alien and somehow crawlingly dreadful, and he supposed that none of them would ever be able to see another one, if we ever get out of this, without feeling a shudder of revulsion. But a spider was, after all, only a spider. Perhaps at the end, when the masks of horror were laid aside, there was nothing with which the human mind could not cope. That was a heartening thought. Anything except the deadlights. Whatever had been out there. But perhaps even that unspeakable living light which crouched at the doorway to the macroverse was dead or dying. The deadlights, and the trip into the black to the place where they had been, was already growing hazy and hard to recall in his mind. And that wasn't really the point. The point felt but not grasped, was simply that the fellowship was ending. It was ending, and they were still in the dark. That other had, through their friendship, perhaps been able to make them something more than children. But they were becoming children again. Bill felt it as much as the others. "What now, Bill?" Richie asked, finally saying it right out.
I don't know,
Bill said. His stutter was back, alive and well. He heard it, they heard it, and he stood in the dark, smelling the sodden aroma of their growing panic, wondering how long it would be before somebody—Stan, most likely it would be Stan—tore things wide open by saying, "Well, why don't you know? You got us into this!" "And what about Henry?" Mike asked uneasily. "Is he still out there, or what?" "Oh, geez," Eddie said, almost moaned. "I forgot about him. Sure he is, sure he is! He's probably as lost as we are, and we could run into him any time. Geez, Bill, don't you have any ideas? Your dad works down here. Don't you have any ideas at all?" Bill listened to the distant mocking thunder of the water and tried to have the idea that Eddie, all of them, had a right to demand. Because, yes, correct, he had gotten them into this, and it was his responsibility to get them back out again. Nothing came. Nothing.
"I have an idea," Beverly said quietly. In the dark, Bill heard a sound he could not immediately place. A whispery little sound, but not scary. Then there was a more easily placed sound. A zipper. "What?" he thought. And then he realized what. She was undressing. For some reason, Beverly was undressing.
"What are you doing?" Richie asked, and his shocked voice cracked on the last word.
"I know something," Beverly said in the dark, and to Bill her voice sounded older. "I know because my father told me. I know how to bring us back together. And if we're not together, we'll never get out."
"What?" Ben asked, sounding bewildered and terrified. "What are you talking about?"
"Something that will bring us together forever. Something that will show—"
"No, Beverly!" Bill said, suddenly understanding everything.
"That will show that I love you all," Beverly said, "that you're all my friends."
Mike began.
Calmly, Beverly cut across his words. "Who's first?" she asked. "I think—"
8. In the Lair of It. 1985.
"He's dying," Beverly wept. "His arm! It ate his arm!"
She reached for Bill, clung to him, and Bill shook her off. "It's getting away again!" he roared at her. Blood caked his lips and chin. "Come on! Richie! Ben! This time, we're gonna finish her!"
Richie turned Bill toward him, looked at him as you would look at a man who is hopelessly raving.
"Bill! We have to take care of Eddie. We have to get a tourniquet on him. Get him out of here."
But Beverly was now sitting with Eddie's head in her lap, cradling him. She had closed his eyes.
"Go with Bill," she said. "If you let him die for nothing, if it comes back in another 25 years or 50 or even 2,000, I swear I'll haunt your ghosts. Go!"
Richie looked at her for a moment, indecisive. Then he became aware that her face was losing definition, becoming not a face, but a pale shape in the growing shadows. The light was fading. It decided him.
"All right," he said to Bill. "This time we chase."
Ben was standing in back of the spider web, which had begun to decay again. He had also seen the shape swaying high up in it, and he prayed that Bill would not look up. But as the web began to fall in drifts and strands and skeins, Bill did. He saw Audra, sagging as if in a very old and creaky elevator. She dropped 10 feet, stopped, swaying from side to side, and then abruptly dropped another 15. Her face never changed. Her eyes, china blue, were wide open. Her bare feet swung back and forth like pendulums. Her hair hung lankly over her shoulders. Her mouth was ajar.
"Audra!"
he screamed.
"Bill, come on!" Ben shouted.
The web was falling all around them now, thudding to the floor and beginning to run. Richie suddenly grabbed Bill around the waist and propelled him forward, shooting for a 10-foot-high gap between the floor and the bottommost crossed strand of the sagging web.
"Go, Bill! Go! Go! That's Audra!"
Bill shouted desperately. "That's Audra!"
"I don't give a shit if it's the Pope," Richie said grimly. "Eddie's dead and we're gonna kill it. If it's still alive, we're gonna finish the job this time, Big Bill. Either she's alive or she's not. Now come on!"
Bill hung back a moment longer, and then snapshots of the children, all the dead children, seemed to flutter through his mind like lost photographs from George's album. School friends.
All right, let's go. God forgive me.
He and Richie ran under the strand of cross-webbing seconds before it collapsed and joined Ben on the other side. They ran after it as Audra swung and dangled 50 feet above the stone floor, wrapped in a numbing cocoon that was attached to the decaying web. 9. Ben. They followed the trail of its black blood, oily pools of ichor that ran and dripped into the cracks between the flagstones. But as the floor began to rise toward a semicircular black opening at the far side of the chamber, Ben saw something new. A trail of eggs. Each was black and rough-shelled, perhaps as big as an ostrich egg. A waxy light shone from within them. Ben realized they were semi-transparent. He could see black shapes moving inside.
"It's children," he thought,
and felt his gorge rise. "It's miscarried children. God! God!" Richie and Bill had stopped and were staring at the eggs with stupid, dazed wonder.
"Go on! Go on!" Ben shouted. "I'll take care of them! Get it!"
"Here!" Richie shouted, and threw Ben a pack of Derry townhouse matches. Ben caught them. Bill and Richie ran on. Ben watched them in the rapidly dimming light for a moment. They ran into the darkness of its escape passage and were lost from sight. Then he looked down at the first of the thin-shelled eggs, at the black, mantle-like shadow inside, and felt his determination waver. Hey, guys. This was too much. This was simply too awful. And surely they would die without his help. They had not been so much laid as dropped. But its time was close. And if one of them is capable of surviving, even one... Summoning all of his courage, summoning up Eddie's pale, dying face, Ben brought one Desert Driver boot down on the first egg. It broke with a sodden squelch as some stinking placenta ran out around his boot. Then a spider the size of a rat was scrabbling weakly across the floor, trying to get away, and Ben could hear it in his head, its high mewling cries like the sound of a handsaw being bent rapidly back and forth so that it makes ghost music. Ben lurched after it on legs that felt like stilts and brought his foot down again. He felt the spider's body crunch and splatter under the heel of his boot, his gorge clenched, and this time there was no way he could hold back. He vomited, then twisted his heel, grinding the thing into the stones, listening to the cries in his head fade to nothing. How many eggs? Didn't I read somewhere that spiders can lay thousands? Or millions? I can't keep doing this. I'll go mad. You have to. You have to. Come on, Ben. Get it together. He went to the next egg and repeated the process in the last of the dying light. Everything was repeated. The brittle snap, the squelch of liquid, the final coup de grace. The next. The next. The next. Making his way slowly toward the black arch into which his friends had gone. The darkness was complete now. Beverly and the decaying web somewhere behind him. He could still hear the whisper of its collapse. The eggs were pallid stones in the dark. As he reached each one, he struck a light from the matchbook and broke it open. In each case, he was able to follow the course of the dazed spiderling and crush it before the light flickered out. He had no idea how he was going to proceed if his matches gave out before he had crushed the last of the eggs and killed each one's unspeakable cargo. 10. It. 1985.
Still coming.
It sensed them still coming, gaining, and its fear grew. Perhaps it was not eternal after all. The unthinkable must finally be thought. Worse, it sensed the death of its young. A third of these hated, hateful men-boys was walking steadily up its trail of birth, almost insane with revulsion, but continuing nonetheless, methodically stamping the life from each of its eggs.
No!
It wailed, lurching from side to side, feeling its life force running from 100 wounds, none of them mortal in itself, but each a song of pain, each slowing it. One of its legs hung by a single living twist of meat. One of its eyes was blind. It sensed a terrible rupture inside, the result of whatever poison one of the hated men-boys had managed to shoot down its throat. And still they came on, closing the distance. And how could this happen? It whined and mewled, and when it sensed them almost directly behind, it did the only thing it could do now. It turned to fight. 11. Beverly. Before the last of the light faded and utter dark closed down, she saw Bill's wife plunge another 20 feet and then fetch up again. She'd begun to spin, her long red hair fanning out. His wife, she thought. But I was his first love, and if he thought some other woman was his first, it was only because he forgot Derry. Then she was in darkness, alone with the sound of the falling web and Eddie's simple, moveless weight. She didn't want to let him go, didn't want to let his face lie on the foul floor of this place. So she held his head in the crook of an arm that had gone mostly numb and brushed his hair away from his damp forehead. She thought of the birds. That was something she supposed she had gotten from Stan. Poor Stan, who hadn't been able to face this. All of them. I was their first love. She tried to remember it. It was something good to think about in all this darkness, where you couldn't place the sounds. It made her feel less alone. At first it wouldn't come. The image of the birds intervened. Crows and grackles and starlings, spring birds that came back from somewhere while the streets were still running with meltwater, and the last patches of crusted, dirty snow clung grimly to their shady places. It seemed to her that it was always on a cloudy day that you first heard and saw those spring birds and wondered where they came from. Suddenly, they were just back in Derry, filling the white air with their raucous chatter. They lined the telephone wires and roof peaks of the Victorian houses on West Broadway. They jostled for places on the aluminum branches of the elaborate TV antenna on top of Wally's Spa. They loaded the wet black branches of the elms on Lower Main Street. They settled, they talked to each other in the screamy, babbling voices of old country women at the weekly Grange bingo games, and then, at some signal which humans could not discern, they all took wing at once, turning the sky black with their numbers, and came down somewhere else. Yes, the birds. I was thinking of them because I was ashamed. It was my father who made me ashamed, I guess. And maybe that was its doing, too. Maybe. The memory came, the memory behind the birds, but it was vague and disconnected. Perhaps this one always would be. She had... Her thoughts broke off as she realized that Eddie... 12. Love and Desire. August 10th, 1958. Comes to her first, because he is the most frightened. He comes to her not as her friend of that summer, or as her brief lover now, but the way he would have come to his mother only 3 or 4 years ago, to be comforted. He doesn't draw back from her smooth nakedness, and at first she doubts if he even feels it. He is trembling, and although she holds him, the darkness is so perfect that even this close she cannot see him. Except for the rough cast, he might as well be a phantom. "What do you want?" he asks her. You have to put your thing in me, she says. He tries to pull back, but she holds him, and he subsides against her. She has heard someone, Ben, she thinks, draw in his breath.
Beffy, I can't do that. I don't know how.
I think it's easy, but you'll have to get undressed. She thinks about the intricacies of managing cast and shirt, first somehow separating and then rejoining them, and amends. Your pants, anyway.
No, I can't.
But she thinks part of him can, and wants to, because his trembling has stopped, and she feels something small and hard which presses against the right side of her belly. You can, she says, and pulls him down. The surface beneath her bare back and legs is firm, clayey, dry. The distant thunder of the water is drowsy, soothing. She reaches for him. There's a moment when her father's face intervenes, harsh and forbidding. I want to see if you're intact. And then she closes her arms around Eddie's neck, her smooth cheek against his smooth cheek. And as he tentatively touches her small breasts, she sighs and thinks for the first time, this is Eddie. And she remembers a day in July, could it only have been last month, when no one else turned up in the Barrens but Eddie, and he had a whole bunch of Little Lulu comic books, and they read together for most of the afternoon. Little Lulu looking for beebleberries and getting in all sorts of crazy situations, Witch Hazel, all of those guys. It had been fun. She thinks of birds, in particular of the grackles and starlings and crows that come back in the spring, and her hands go to his belt and loosen it, and he says again that he can't do that. She tells him that he can. She knows he can. And what she feels is not shame or fear now, but a kind of triumph. Where? He says, and that hard thing pushes urgently against her inner thigh. Here, she says.
Bevy, I'll fall on you,
he says, and she hears his breath start to whistle painfully. I think that's sort of the idea, she tells him, and holds him gently and guides him. He pushes forward too fast, and there is pain. She draws her breath in, her teeth biting at her lower lip, and thinks of the birds again, the spring birds, lining the roof peaks of houses, taking wing all at once under low March clouds. Beverly, he says uncertainly, are you okay?
Go slower, she says.
It'll be easier for you to breathe. He does move more slowly, and after a while his breathing speeds up, but she understands this is not because there is anything wrong with him. The pain fades. Suddenly he moves more quickly, then stops, stiffens, and makes a sound, some sound. She senses that this is something for him, something extraordinarily special, something like flying. She feels powerful. She feels a sense of triumph rise up strongly within her. Is this what her father was afraid of? Well, he might be. There was power in this act, all right. A chain-breaking power that was blood deep. She feels no physical pleasure, but there is a kind of mental ecstasy in it for her. She senses the closeness. He puts his face against her neck and she holds him. He's crying. She holds him and feels the part of him that made a connection between them begin to fade. It is not leaving her exactly. It is simply fading, becoming less. When his weight shifts away, she sits up and touches his face in the darkness. Did I what? Whatever it is, I don't know exactly. He shakes his head. She feels it with her hand against his cheek. I don't think it was exactly like, you know, like the big boys say, but it was really something. He speaks low so the others can't hear. I love you, Bevy. Her consciousness breaks down a little there. She's quite sure there's more talk, some whispered, some loud, and can't remember what is said. It doesn't matter. Does she have to talk each of them into it all over again? Yes, probably. But it doesn't matter. They have to be talked into it, this essential human link between the world and the infinite, the only place where the bloodstream touches eternity. It doesn't matter. What matters is love and desire. Here, in this dark, is as good a place as any. Better than some, maybe. Mike comes to her. Then Richie, and the act is repeated. Now she feels some pleasure, dim heat in her childish, unmatured sex, and she closes her eyes as Stan comes to her, and she thinks of the birds, spring and the birds, and she sees them again and again, all lighting at once, filling up the winter-naked trees, shockwave riders on the moving edge of nature's most violent season. She sees them take wing again and again, the flutter of their wings like the snap of many sheets on the line, and she thinks, a month from now, every kid in Derry Park will have a kite. They'll run to keep the strings from getting tangled with each other. She thinks again, this is what flying is like. With Stan, as with the others, there is that rueful sense of fading, of leaving, with whatever they truly need from this act, some ultimate close, but as yet unfound. Did you? She asks again, and although she doesn't know exactly what it is, she knows that he hasn't. There is a long wait, and then Ben comes to her. He is trembling all over, but it is not the fearful trembling she felt in Stan. Beverly, I can't, he says in a tone which purports to be reasonable and is anything but. You can too. I can feel it. She sure can. There's more of this hardness, more of him. She can feel it below the gentle push of his belly. Its size raises a certain curiosity, and she touches the bulge lightly. He groans against her neck, and the blow of his breath causes her bare body to dimple with goosebumps. She feels the first twist of real heat race through her. Suddenly, the feeling in her is very large. She recognizes that it is too big. And is he too big? Can she take that into herself? And too old for her. Something, some feeling that walks in boots. This is like Henry's M80s. Something not meant for kids. Something that could explode and blow you up. But this was not the place or time for worry. Here, there was love, desire, and the dark. If they didn't try for the first two, they would surely be left with the last. Beverly, don't! Yes, I... Show me how to fly, she says with a calmness she doesn't feel, aware by the fresh, wet warmth on her cheek and neck that he has begun to cry. Show me, Ben.
No.
If you wrote the poem, show me. Feel my hair if you want to, Ben. It's all right.
Beverly, I...
He's not just trembling now. He's shaking all over. But she senses again that this ague is not all fear. Part of it is the precursor of the throw this act is all about. She thinks of the birds, his face, his dear, sweet, earnest face, and knows it is not fear. It is wanting, he feels, a deep, passionate wanting now, barely held in check. And she feels that sense of power again, something like flying, something like looking down from above and seeing all the birds on the roof peaks, on the TV antenna atop Wally's, seeing streets spread out map-like. Oh, desire. Right. This was something. It was love and desire that taught you to fly. Ben! Yes, she cries suddenly, and the leash breaks. She feels pain again, and for a moment there is the frightening sensation of being crushed. Then he props himself up on the palms of his hands, and that feeling is gone. He's big. Oh, yes, the pain is back, and it's much deeper than when Eddie first entered her. She has to bite her lip again and think of the birds until the burning is gone. But it does go, and she is able to reach up and touch his lips with one finger, and he moans. The heat is back, and she feels her power suddenly shift to him. She gives it gladly and goes with it. There is a sensation first of being rocked, of a delicious spiraling sweetness which makes her begin to turn her head helplessly from side to side, and a tuneless humming comes from between her closed lips. This is flying, this, oh, love. Oh, desire. Oh, this is something impossible to deny. Binding. Giving. Making a strong circle. Binding. Giving. Flying. Oh, Ben. Oh, my dear. Yes. she whispers, feeling the sweat stand out on her face, feeling their connection something firmly in place, something like eternity. The number 8 rocked over on its side. I love you so much, dear. And she feels the thing begin to happen, something of which the girls who whisper and giggle about sex in the girls' room have no idea, at least as far as she knows. They only marvel at how gushy sex must be. And now she realizes that for many of them, sex must be some unrealized, undefined monster. They refer to the act as it. Would you do it? Do your sister and her boyfriend do it? Do your mom and dad still do it? And how they never intend to do it. Oh, yes. You would think that the whole girls' side of the 5th grade class was made up of spinsters to be, and it is obvious to Beverly that none of them can suspect this. This conclusion, and she is only kept from screaming by her knowledge that the others will hear and think her badly hurt. She puts the side of her hand in her mouth and bites down hard. She understands the screamy laughter of Greta Bowie and Sally Muller and all the others better now. Hadn't they, the 7 of them, spent most of this, the longest, scariest summer of their lives, laughing like loons? You laugh because what's fearful and unknown is also what's funny. You laugh the way a small child will sometimes laugh and cry at the same time when a capering circus clown approaches, knowing it is supposed to be funny. But it is also unknown, full of the unknown's eternal power. Biting her hand will not stay the cry, and she can only reassure them and Ben by crying out her affirmative in the darkness. Yes! 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 Glorious images of flight fill her head, mixing with the harsh calling of the grackles and starlings. These sounds become the world's sweetest music. So she flies. She flies up, and now the power is not with her or with him, but somewhere between them. And he cries out, and she can feel his arms trembling, and she arches up and into him, feeling his spasm, his touch, his total fleeting intimacy with her in the dark. They break through into the life light together. Then it is over, and they are in each other's arms. And when he tries to say something, perhaps some stupid apology that would hurt what she remembers, some stupid apology like a handcuff, she stops his words with a kiss and sends him away. Bill comes to her. He tries to say something, but his stutter is almost total now. You be quiet, she says, secure in her new knowledge, but aware that she is tired now, tired and damned sore. The insides and backs of her thighs feel sticky, and she thinks it's maybe because Ben actually finished, or maybe because she's bleeding. Everything is going to be totally okay. Are you sure? Yes, she says, and links her hands behind his neck, feeling the sweaty mat of his hair. You just bet. It is not as it was with Ben. There is passion, but not the same kind. Being with Bill now is the best conclusion to this that there could be. He is kind, tender, just short of calm. She senses his eagerness, but it is tempered and held back by his anxiety for her, perhaps because only Bill and she herself realize what an enormous act this is, and how it must never be spoken of, not to anyone else, not even to each other. At the end, she's surprised by that sudden upsurge, and she has time to think, oh, it's going to happen again. I don't know if I can stand it. But her thoughts are swept away by the utter sweetness of it, and she barely hears him whispering, I love you, Bev. I love you. I'll always love you, saying it over and over, and not stuttering at all. She hugs him to her, and for a moment they stay that way, his smooth cheek against hers. He withdraws from her without saying anything, and for a little while she's alone, pulling her clothes back together, slowly putting them on, aware of a dull, throbbing pain of which they, being male, will never know, aware also of a certain exhausted pleasure and the relief of having it over. There's an emptiness down there now, and although she is glad that her sex is her own again, The emptiness imparts a strange melancholy, which she could never express, except to think of bare trees under a white winter sky, empty trees, trees waiting for blackbirds to come like ministers at the end of March to preside over the death of snow. She finds them by groping for their hands. For a moment, no one speaks, and when someone does, it does not surprise her much that it's Eddie. I think when we went right 2 turns back, we should have gone left. Geez, I knew that, but I was so sweaty and frigged up. Been frigged up your whole life, Eds, Richie says. His voice is pleasant. The raw edge of panic is completely gone. We went wrong some other places, too, Eddie says, ignoring him. But that's the worst one. If we can find our way back there, we just might be okay. They form up in a clumsy line, Eddie first, Beverly second now, her hand on Eddie's shoulder as Mike's is on hers. They begin to move again, faster this time. Eddie displays none of his former nervous care. We're going home, she thinks, and shivers with relief and joy. Home, yes. And that will be good. We've done our job, what we came for. Now we can go back to just being kids again. And that will be good, too. As they move through the dark, she realizes the sound of running water is closer.